The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
That kind introduction. I am delighted to be here. I enormously admire and I'm grateful for all the work that you do. And my reasons for being admiring and grateful become clear in the remarks that I'm going to share with you today on constitutional structures, civic virtues, and the public order. Now, those of us who are citizens of liberal democracies tend not to refer to those who govern us as rulers. It's our boast that we rule ourselves. And there's truth in this, in as much as we participate in choosing those who do rule. So we prefer to speak of presidents and governors and other high officials not as our rulers, but as servants. We call them public servants. Or at least we refer to them, or they refer to themselves, as people being in public service. A politician might say, well, in my 27 years in public service, referring to the time he's been in office. Now, of course, these so-called servants are nothing remotely like the servants in, say, Downton Abbey. The extraordinary prestige and usually the trappings attaching to public office in just about all times and places would by themselves be sufficient to distinguish, say, the mayor of Pittsburgh, or the governor of Pennsylvania, or the president of the United States from Carson the butler. But that prestige signals an underlying fact that discomfits our democratic and egalitarian sensibilities, namely, the fact that even in liberal democracies, high public officials are rulers. They make the rules. They enforce them. They resolve disputes about their meaning and applicability. To a very large extent, at the end of the day, what they say goes. Think of all the regulations under which we operate, even in private, even in religious schools. Now, of course, our rulers rule not by dint of sheer power, the way the mafia might do in a territory over which it happens to have gained control, but rather they rule lawfully, according to law. Constitutional rules specify public offices and settle procedures for filling them. So though holders of public office are indeed rulers, they're not absolute rulers. Constitutional rules set the scope and thus the limits of their jurisdiction and authority. They are rulers who are themselves subject to rules. They rule in limited ways, and ordinarily, of course, for limited terms, which may or may not be indefinitely renewable at the pleasure of the voters. They rule by virtue of democratic processes by which they come to hold office. They can be removed or significantly disempowered at the next election if the people aren't happy with them. Still, for all that, they rule. It's what they do. Now, my point here is not to hoot at the idea of government and those holding governmental offices and controlling the levers of governmental power as servants. On the contrary, I want in the end to defend the idea that rulers truly can be and should be servants. I want to establish, however, that if these people we call public servants are indeed servants, they're servants in a special sense, a sense that is compatible with them at the same time being rulers. They are people who serve us by ruling. They serve us well by ruling well. If they rule badly, they serve us poorly. They disserve us. Now, there are, of course, lots of ways that rulers can disserve those whom they have the moral obligation to serve by ruling well. Most obviously, there is incompetence. Then, of course, there is corruption. And at the extreme, there is tyranny. So what does it mean for the ruler truly to be a servant? What does it mean for someone holding political office and exercising public power to rule well? Well, it means making and executing decisions for the sake of the common good, not for the sake of tribal or partisan or personal interests. Such decisions will necessarily be compatible with the requirements of justice and at the same time embody justice. If we understand the concept of the common good properly, and I'll say a word about that in a moment, then we will see that no decision that violates the requirements of justice, respect for religious freedom, respect for other basic liberties, is truly for the common good. And no decision that genuinely upholds and serves the common good will fail to advance the cause of justice. Now, of course, reasonable people of goodwill can and often do disagree about what the common good requires and forbids. They disagree, we disagree amongst ourselves about what the truth is, about what is just and unjust. And honorable people exercising public power can commit injustices, even grave injustices, while seeking in good faith to do justice and believing in good faith that they are doing it. Sincerity is not a guarantee of substantive justice. Good motives, good intentions do not mean that a rule or a law is just. So just as not all violations of the common good are injustices, not all injustices are the result of malice or ill will or like vices. Still, all injustices, even if committed by officials who are sincerely trying to do the right thing, advance some good cause, anti-discrimination or what have you, harm the common good. For justice itself is a common good. It's a good that all of us share in common. Justice is good for all of us. And a central aspect of the common good of political community, the political community. It's to the benefit of each and every member of the community, each and every citizen, to live in a just social order. And harm to that order, injustice within that order, is therefore a loss for everyone and not merely for the immediate and obvious victims of any particular injustice. Indeed, it's a loss even for those who are the ostensible beneficiaries of the injustice. And indeed, even for the perpetrators of injustice, though naturally true evildoers don't see it that way. Corruption of character has narrowed their vision of the good, blinding them to the profound respects in which wrongdoing harms what is in truth their own interest, as much as anyone else's, in living in a just society. Now, the common good requires that there be rulers and that they rule. We cannot get along without rulers. To grasp this is to begin to see the sense in which good rulers are also servants. Members of society face a range, sometimes a vast range, especially in complex modern societies, of challenges and opportunities requiring various types of coordination, including in the case of complex societies, coordination problems presented by the large number and the complexity of other coordination problems. Since such problems cannot, as a practical matter, be resolved or addressed by unanimity or by holding an old-fashioned New England-style town meeting, even with the advantages of modern social media and technology, authority, political authority, is required. Institutions will have to be created and maintained, and persons will need to be installed in the offices of these institutions to make the choices and decisions that must be made and to do the things that must be done for the sake of protecting public health, safety, and morals, upholding the rights and dignity of individuals and of families and of governmental entities, non-governmental entities of various descriptions, and advancing the overall common good. And this would be true even in a society of perfect saints, where no one ever sought more than his or her fair share from the common stock, or violated the rights of others, or deliberately acted in any manner that was contrary to the common good. Even in such a society, effective coordination for the sake of common goals, and thus for the common good of all, would be required. And seeking unanimity, assuming a large and fairly complex society, would not be a practical option. So authority would be required, and that means persons exercising authority, rulers ruling. But the moral justification for the rulers ruling is service to the good of all, the common good. And the common good is not an abstraction or a platonic form hovering somewhere out there beyond the concrete well-being of flesh and blood human beings. They're flourishing. It just is the well-being of the persons constituting the community and of the families and other associations of civil society, associations of persons, what Edmund Burke called the little platoons of civil society, of which persons are members. The right of legitimate rulers to rule is rooted in the duty of rulers to rule in the interest of all. In other words, the basis of the right to rule is the duty to serve. And the realities that constitute the content of service are the various elements of the common good. By doing what is for the common good and by avoiding doing anything that harms the common good, good rulers fulfill their obligations to the people over whom they exercise authority, thus serving in their interests, their welfare, serving their flourishing, in a word, serving them. But how is the common good of the political community, the common good served by good rulers, and to which citizens too have responsibilities, best understood? It's a classic question of political philosophy, and not just modern political philosophy. Is the common good of the polity, of political society, fundamentally an intrinsic good or an instrumental good? Is it something we want for the sake of itself, intrinsic good, or something we want for the sake of other things to which it is a means, and in that sense an instrumental good? Well, there is in what the late Sir Isaiah Berlin referred to as the central tradition of Western thought about morality, including political morality, a powerful current of belief that the common good of political society is an intrinsic good. This seems clearly to have been the view of Aristotle, and many self-identified followers of Aristotle's greatest interpreter and expositor, Thomas Aquinas, are firmly convinced that it was Thomas's view, too. Professor John Finnis of Oxford University, one of our leading interpreters of Aquinas and Aristotle, however, argues that the common good of political society, though, to quote Aristotle, great and godlike in its range and importance, is nevertheless fundamentally an instrumental and not an intrinsic good. And he further argues that the instrumental nature of the common good of political society entails limitations of the legitimate scope of governmental authority, limitations that, though not in every case easily articulable in the language of rights, are requirements of justice, and therefore requirements that, as a matter of justice, rulers respect, not overstepping the bounds of their authority. And rulers here applies not only to executives, but to legislators, and indeed to judges who make rules, sometimes under the guise of merely interpreting rules, and who are bound as a matter of justice to respect the limits of their authority and not to invent constitutional law instead of simply applying it, which is what they're supposed to do. Now, a way we've come to think about these limits is in terms of what is usually these days called the doctrine of subsidiarity. 80 years ago, a pope, Pope Pius XI, in an encyclical called Quasi Jesimo Anno, 1931, explained the basic idea, and it's hard to improve on his account of what subsidiarity means. Here it is. Just as it is wrong to withdraw from the individual and commit to a group what private initiative and effort can accomplish, so too it is wrong for a larger and higher association to arrogate to itself functions that can be performed efficiently and well by smaller and lower associations. This is a fixed, unchanging, and most weighty principle of moral philosophy. Of its very nature, the true aim of all social activities should be to help members of a social body and never to absorb or to destroy them. You might, unquote. You might consider what the Pope has to say here about subsidiarity in light of the question of the relationship between public and private education. The Pope says it is wrong to withdraw from the individual and commit to a group what private initiative can accomplish. So too it is wrong for a larger and higher association to arrogate to itself functions which can be performed efficiently by smaller and lower associations. Now, this principle of justice and the common good that we call subsidiarity reflects a particular understanding of the nature and content of human flourishing. Flourishing consists in doing things, not just in getting things or having desirable or pleasant experiences or having things given to you or having things done for you. This is something that's often overlooked these days. It's something that we have to help our young people to understand, and it's an insight as old as Aristotle. The flourishing of any individual human being consists in activity, in the doing of things. Not just in having pleasant experiences, not just in having things done for you, not just in being given things. The good consists in activity. Human goods are realized by acting persons. Persons participate in human goods, thus enriching their lives and ennobling themselves as they exercise and fulfill their natural human capacities. For example, our capacity for friendship, or our capacity for knowledge, or our capacity for critical aesthetic appreciation. You only realize those goods by activity, not by being given things. They are not reducible to experience. You don't just want the experience of friendship, or of beautiful art, or of knowledge, or the pursuit of knowledge, which you might have in a dream, or in a drug-induced fantasy. You want the reality. We can distinguish experience from reality, and the human good consists in the activity, the reality, not in its mere experiential component. And so the common good is best conceived as a set of conditions, conditions enabling members of a community to attain for themselves reasonable objectives or to realize reasonably for themselves the values for the sake of which they have reason to form a community in the first place, whether the community is a political society or a private Christian school, or a Boy Scout troop, or a family. Its elements are what enable people to do things individually and in cooperation with others, the doing of which to a significant degree constitutes their all-round or integral flourishing. Under favoring conditions, people can more fully and more successfully carry out reasonable projects, pursue reasonable objectives, and thus participate in human goods, including goods that are inherently social in that they fulfill persons in respect of the social dimension of their being, their capacity for non-instrumental forms of interpersonal communion like friendships or family relationships, marriages, that are indeed constitutive of their well-being and fulfillment, their flourishing. Properly understood, then, the common good requires, as a matter of justice, limits on governmental power. The state must not, lest it commit injustice, take over civil society. There must be plenty of room for robust institutions of civil society, not under the control of the state. And this includes very, very centrally education. We can debate whether there should be state schools. The founding father of modern liberalism, John Stuart Mill, argued that there should not be. But surely there must be room for private and religious education as well. The state cannot monopolize education and opportunities for education without committing a grave injustice by overstepping its just authority. So properly understood, the common good requires limited government, government that respects the needs and rights of the people to pursue objectives and realize goods for themselves and their children, and to do it for themselves and their children. The fundamental role of legitimate government, and thus the responsibility of legitimate rulers, rulers who serve, is not to be doing things for people that they could do themselves or for themselves, including organizing the education of their children. It is rather to be helping to establish and maintain conditions that favor people's doing things for themselves and with and for each other. Government should do things for people, as opposed to letting them do things for themselves, only where individuals and non-governmental institutions of civil society cannot do them, or cannot reasonably be expected to do them efficiently or well for themselves. Protecting the nation against a nuclear-powered enemy is not something that any individual or family or local community can do for itself. And so under the principle of subsidiarity, there would be no objection to the nation state taking responsibility for the security of the people as a whole. But deciding whether to feed the kids broccoli, that's not for the nation state. My kids think that's not even for the parents. Now, this facilitative conception of the common good does not require a doctrinaire libertarianism, either in the domain of political economy or social morality. But it does clearly exclude corporatist and socialist policies that, to recall those words from Pope Pius XI, withdraw from the individual and commit to the group what private initiative and individual effort can accomplish. Or, back in my own words, which remove from the family or the religious or civic association, including the private school to which the family chooses to send children, and commit to government what can be accomplished by non-governmental collaborative effort. Surely a conception of the common good that is serious about the principle of subsidiarity will respect private property and take care to maintain reasonably free systems of economic exchange, a market economy. Social, that is, comprehensive or even widespread state ownership or control of the means of production and of education, is plainly incompatible with subsidiarity's concerns and objectives, as is anything remotely resembling a command economy or the monopolization of the means of production or of education. And this would be true even if the record of socialist states were benign when it came to civil liberties and respect for political freedom, which on the whole, it is not. And it would be true even if, again, contrary to the historical record, private property and the market system and respect for private education were not necessary checks against the excessive concentration and abuse of power in the hands of public officials. But as I've noted, the historical record does demonstrate that private property and the market system and choice in education, including private and including religious education, while not sufficient guarantees against the concentration and abuse of state power, are for all intents and purposes necessary conditions for civil liberty and limited government. And there, by the way, was the reason that John Stuart Mill, not a religious man, a founding father, as I say, of modern liberalism, it's for those reasons that Mill opposed state education. He was concerned about the emergence of a state monopoly that would imperil civil liberties, most centrally, freedom of thought. The control of curricula by the state being used to indoctrinate children in state-approved ideologies. Mill's writing in the middle of the 19th century. That's a vision, that guy. And there's a profound lesson for this of the profound lesson in this. For those of us who are interested in ensuring that rulers remain servants, ruling in the interests of citizens, and do not reduce citizens to a condition of dependency or servitude. For it is critical to the effective limitation of governmental power that there be substantial non-governmental centers of power in society. Private property, the market economy, permission and access to private education not only provide conditions for social mobility, which is important to the common good in any modern dynamic society, but also ensure that there are significant resources and opportunities for people in the private associations they form that are not in the control, not under the control of governmental officials or the apparatus of the state. This diffusion of power broadly in society benefits society as a whole, benefits the common good, the good of all, and not only those who immediately benefit economically from the possession of property or the ability to profit in a market or the ability to educate their children in the way that they deem fit, including in relation to their religious beliefs. And I'm not simply here talking about general prosperity, though that is yet another benefit of a system of freedom in these matters. I'm talking about the benefit to all in terms of liberty, opportunity, and security of the diffusion of economic and other forms of power, including in education. And this does go well beyond economics. If we understand the common good, if we have a grasp of what constitutes or is conducive to the flourishing of human beings and what is not, we will recognize that limited government with plenty of room for civil society to operate is also important because it permits the functioning and flourishing of non-governmental institutions of civil society, those little platoons, including private education, that perform better than any government could ever conceivably do the most essential health, education, and welfare functions, and which play the primary role, and must play the primary role, in any society, a role that government simply cannot perform, of transmitting to each new generation the virtues without which free societies cannot survive. Basic honesty, integrity, self-restraint, concern for others and respect for their dignity and rights, civic-mindedness, and the like. These non-governmental authority structures, beginning with the marriage-based family, represent another crucial way in which power is properly diffused and not concentrated in the hands of the state and its officials. These institutions can play their role only when government is limited. For unlimited government, state monopolizing always usurps the authority of the family and other institutions of civil society and destroys their autonomy, usually recruiting or commandeering them into being state functionary organs. And where they are playing their proper role, they help to create the conditions in which the ideal of limited government is itself more likely to be realized and preserved than its benefits enjoyed by the people. Where there's robust civil society, there are resources for keeping the government in check. Something that, as Jefferson reminded us in his famous remark about the cost of liberty being eternal vigilance, something as Jefferson reminded, we never get past. There will never, in all of this, as long as there are human beings on this earth, or creatures like us on this earth, we will always have the need to worry about government overstepping its power, intruding into civic life in ways that undermine the autonomy and authority of institutions of civil society and violate the rights of families and individuals. So a critical element of any discussion of the quality of democratic deliberation and decision-making that amounts to anything more than hot air will be the indispensable role of non-governmental institutions of civil society in sustaining a culture in which political institutions do what they are supposed to do, do it reasonably well, and don't do what they are not authorized to do. And so we must be mindful that bad behavior on the part of political institutions, power grabs, which means bad behavior on the part of the people who exercise power as public office holders, the people who do the power grabbing, can weaken, enervate, and even corrupt these institutions of civil society, rendering them, for all intents and purposes, impotent to resist the bad behavior and useless to the cause of political reform. Now, none of what I have just said is to deny the importance of constitutional structural constraints on power. They are very important indeed. Most of my time, because I'm a teacher of constitutional law, most of my time, certainly in my classrooms, I spend giving a very different speech or lecture. I spend giving a lecture on the importance of constitutional structural constraints. Separation of powers, federalism, the idea of the national government as a government of delegated and enumerated powers, and the states as governments of general jurisdiction. So I'm not denigrating that at all. I think these constitutional constraints are very important. But I'm here today to tell you that the experience of our nation and of other nations shows all too well that structural constraints will be effective only where they are effectually supported by the people, that is, by the political culture. The people need to understand those constraints, those constitutional principles. They need to value them, and they need to value them enough to resist usurpations by their rulers, even when unconstitutional programs offer immediate gratifications or the relief of urgent problems. This, in turn, requires virtues, certain virtues among the people. Otherwise, they're going to yield under pressure or tension or out of fear to government usurpations of authority. What are virtues? Virtues are strengths of character, habits, traits of character in the people. But these virtues do not just fall down on people from the heavens. They have to be transmitted through the generations and nurtured by each generation. Madison famously said that, quote, only a well-educated people can be permanently a free people, unquote. And that's true. It points to the fact that even the best constitutional structures, even our cherished Madisonian system of checks and balances, even the strongest structural constraints on governmental power aren't worth the paper they are printed on if people do not understand them, value them, and have the capacity and the will to resist the blandishments of those offering something tempting in return for giving them up or letting violations of them occur without swift and certain political retaliation. But it's also true that virtue is needed. And that's not merely a matter of improving civics teaching in our schools. The Constitution of the United States was famously defended by Madison in Federalist Paper 51 as, quote, supplying by opposite and rival interests the defect of better motives, unquote. He made this point immediately after observing that the first task of government is to control the governed, and the second is to control itself. He allowed that, quote, a dependence on the people is no doubt the primary control on the government, but experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions, hence the constitutional structural constraints. Those are the auxiliary precautions, among other things. But even in this formulation of Madison's, the constitutional structural constraints do not stand alone. Indeed, they are presented as secondary. What is also necessary, and indeed primary, is a healthy and vibrant political culture, a dependence on the people to keep their rulers in line, in check, under control, within the limits of authority delegated to them under the Constitution. But that brings us back to the central role and importance of virtue, and to the institutions, beginning with the family, the church, the school, that transmit virtue. John Adams understood as well as anyone the general theory of the Constitution. Adams was the ablest scholar and political theorist of the founding generation. He doesn't get credit for it. People think that Jefferson was the greatest thinker and the greatest political theorist, but it wasn't Jefferson. Jefferson was good. It was Adams. I think the reason Adams doesn't get the credit he deserves for his ability as a scholar and a political theorist was that he was, as he himself put it, obnoxious and short. Jefferson was genial and tall. But Adams certainly got the point about supplying the defects of better motives. Yet he also understood that the health of political culture was an indispensable element of the success of the constitutional enterprise, an enterprise ensuring that the rulers stay within the bounds of their legitimate authority and indeed be servants of the common good, servants of the people they rule. Adams remarked that, quote, "Our Constitution is made for a moral and religious people and is wholly inadequate to the government of any other," unquote. I don't hear that quoted much in my neck of the woods up in the Ivy League, but there it is. Now, why? Why would Adams say such a thing? It sounds so radical to our ears. Separation of church and state. Well, it's because a people lacking in virtue, Adams recognized, could be counted on, when push came to shove, to trade liberty for security, for protection, for financial or personal gain, for comfort, for being looked after, for being taken care of, for having things done for you, for being given stuff, for having their problems solved. And there will always be people occupying or standing for public office who will be happy to offer the deal, an expansion of their power in return for what they can offer you by virtue of that expansion. That's the shiny apple, that there will always be politicians, no matter, again, as long as there are human beings on the face of the earth, there are going to be politicians offering that shiny apple. So the question then is how to form a people fitted out with the virtues making them worthy of freedom and capable of preserving constitutional liberty, constitutionally limited government, even in the face of strong temptations, which will inevitably come, to compromise it away. And here we see the central political role and significance of the most basic institutions of civil society: the family, the religious community, the school, the small civic group, that are devoted to the inculcation of knowledge and virtue, and private, often religiously based educational institutions are necessary for the transmission of virtue, necessary as a system, the family, mom and dad, grandma and grandpa, in bringing up, forming young people who will have the virtues necessary to lead successful lives and to be good citizens. These institutions, the family, the school, the church, are often said to be mediating institutions that provide a buffer between the individual and the power of the central state. And that's true. It's ultimately the autonomy, integrity, and general flourishing of these institutions that will determine the fate of constitutionally limited government. And this is not only because of their primary and indispensable role in transmitting virtue. It's also because of their performance of health, education, and welfare functions. If they are not there, those functions will be removed to the state, to what the Pope called larger and higher institutions, to government. And we're not guessing or speculating about that. Just look at any place in this country or in the world where civil society is broken down, where families fail to form or disintegrate, large out-of-wedlock childbearing, where schools cannot really function. You have to go through metal detectors even to get into the places where the church no longer has authority. You'll look in those places. It's not as if there's no one who tries to look after health, education, and welfare functions that ordinarily would be looked up after by families, mom and dad, grandma and grandpa, assisted by churches and schools and things like that. No, if there's someone in there trying to do it, they're doing it badly because they have to do it badly, they can't do it well. But that someone is the state. It's the government. And that's the end of limited government. I mean, obviously taxes have to be raised to accommodate all the social service provision and the employees that are needed to provide social services. Policing and penal staff also have to be increased because, naturally, certain pathologies follow in the wake of the disintegration. Social pathologies follow in the wake, and for that matter, physical pathologies follow in the wake of the disintegration of civil society. And so that's it for limited government. When government expands to play the primary role in performing basic health, education, and welfare functions, civil society is pushed out, limited government is soon lost. No matter, by the way, how strong the formal structural constraints of the Constitution are. The Constitution can remain just as it is. Right? Think of really dangerous rundown areas of Chicago or of Los Angeles or some parts of old Rust Belt cities or of Appalachia where I grew up. I come from West Virginia. This is not a minority versus majority problem at all. We now know for sure. Wherever society, civil society disintegrates, we know what the situation is like. Even if the Constitution remains completely the same, the words on the page, to give substance to those words are important. Those constitutional structural constraints, as I've already said, are important. They have a role to play, but they can't play it in the absence of healthy civil society. The late Justice Antonin Scalia used to love to pull out a copy of the old Soviet Constitution. He'd start reading from it. You read all these wonderful freedom of speech, freedom of the press, all these wonderful provisions. I mean, if all you knew about the Soviet Union was the Constitution, you'd say, what a wonderful, but it really is heaven on earth. But it's words on a page, unless they're given substance in the civic life of the people. And when civil society disintegrates, families don't form, or because families don't perform their functions, or can't perform their functions, or the state has made it impossible for them to perform their functions, when the state monopolizes the economy, when it monopolizes education, when you lose a thriving civil society, they obviously cannot perform their health, education, and welfare functions. And with that, they lose their capacity to influence for the good the political culture, which at the end of the day, as Justice Scalia's little thought experiment with the Soviet Constitution reveals, is the whole shooting match when it comes to the question of whether the ruler can and will be truly a servant. Thank you.
Virtue is fundamentally what we're trying to do, and I guess my first question for you would be how we can work to, in cultivating those virtues, re-engage support of the Constitution. I guess the question really comes to, is it possible for the Constitution to continue, as you were just referencing, without a virtue-based educational system?
The answer to that is clearly no, and it's no for the reasons that the Founding Fathers themselves indicated. Washington in his farewell address, or should we say Hamilton in Washington's farewell address, made the central point. It's a good thing for the father of the country to have said, since it is so central, that morality and religion are the central supports upon which the civic order rests. There it is. He understood that from the very beginning. You go all the way back. And this is a nation being established without an established church and rejecting the idea of a national church. And yet, Washington publicly acknowledges, emphatically makes the point that we cannot survive. This experiment will fail unless it has the support of morality and religion. He didn't even just stop with morality, as if you could have morality in large groups sustained over time without religion. Washington himself understood the importance of religion in the project of upholding morality, and of religion and morality in the project of upholding civil society. I quoted to you from Adams, I can quote to you from Madison and other founding fathers. The important thing is not that they said it. The important thing is that it's true. They were smart guys. They thought through how to make Republican government finally work, it having failed in the ancient world and in the medieval and Renaissance world every time it had been tried. So when they were thinking their way through, how are we finally going to make Republican government work? How are we going to preserve liberty in a Republican scheme? They recognized that only a virtue-based citizenry would be fit for Republican government, for self-government. Government, as Lincoln described it, of the people, by the people, and for the people. All government is of the people, right? All good government, even the government of benign despots, is for the people. What's distinctive about Republican government is government by the people. But that effort to establish not only good government, but good government by the people, government for the people, by the people, had failed every time it had been tried. So they realized you need a couple of things. One, you need a new political science. You need a new form of government. You need constitutional structural constraints. That's number one. But number two, those won't work without virtue in the people. And somebody's got to provide for that. Now, who do you think? And who do you think they thought? So two questions. What do you think? What do you think they thought was going to supply virtue for each new generation? Would it be the political system? Would the president issue an edict? Would it be the legal system? Would a judge issue a ruling? Would it be the economic system? Would Google or Microsoft produce it, or Uber? No. They understood perfectly well. It's going to be mom and dad and grandma and grandpa and pastor and Miss Jones, the second grade teacher. There you go.
A scholar, Lawrence Krimmen, talked about the American paideia. I don't know if you've ever heard that term, but he talked about it as being the end of, or the chief end of progressive education, that the idea that starting around the turn of the 20th century, we needed to replace the Christian paideia with an American paideia. I wonder if you have a view of, now that we have pretty much a dominant 95% progressive education system in terms of number of students in it, what the path you could see back to a state where we have education that cultivates the right ordering of affections to that end?
Well, the first thing I would say is, well, you know, we've had the experiment now for a long time, as you say, 95%. Roughly at this point, with secular liberal or liberal secularist or secular progressive paideia. So my first question would be, how's that working out for you? Those locks on the lockers, what are they doing there? Chuck Colson loved to tell a story. He went into a public school and had a lovely meeting with some of the teachers and with the principal. And he saw the locks on the lockers, and he asked the question, why do you have the locks on the lockers there? I mean, this is not a bad neighborhood. I mean, these kids are affluent kids. It's a suburban school. And the principal said, well, I hate to admit it, but we've had a really bad problem here with theft. People stealing stuff, students stealing stuff, members of the staff, stealing things from each other, stealing things from students. And Chuck said, well, why don't you just put a sign up on the wall that says, thou shalt not steal. Now, the way back is that classical Christian schools and other religiously based schools, Jewish day schools, Catholic parochial schools, these institutions are going to have to lead the way by showing that they can produce the goods. Nothing succeeds like success. I want you guys to be so successful that the people in the blob, in the public education establishment, have to come up with even more ways of explaining away the fact that your students lead successful lives and become good citizens, and so many of theirs don't. Make them work really hard to come up with more. They will keep coming up with excuses. You're not going to actually get them to say, okay, throw in the towel, uncle. But make them work by your success. And I think your success is the future of these institutions is not to become just catechism classes. Fine, do catechism. I'm all for that. It has its place. But don't be just that. They, the public education establishment, they're the catechism class people. They're now running indoctrination centers, re-education camps. Don't be like them just in the Christian side. Paideia means paideia. Christian paideia shouldn't be false to paideia the way liberal secularist paideia is false to paideia. It should be, Christian paideia should be true to paideia, that it's deep education, where your students not only understand what is true, but why it's true, and understand its deeper significance, the significance of its being true. And your students, unlike their students, should understand what's to be said on the other side of issues. You shouldn't hide from them the serious critiques of Christianity and Christian morality that have been advanced by serious critics of Christian morality over the centuries. You should have enough faith, I certainly do, in the truth of our moral principles to defend them against the strongest attacks. We don't need to shelter our kids, and we certainly don't need to indoctrinate them. They should know what the Christian faith teaches, obviously. But they should also be prepared to engage the best arguments on the other side. There really is a difference, even in the Christian context, between education and indoctrination. We need to be doing education. If we're doing education for real, then paideia just becomes a redundancy. All real education is paideia.
Thank you very much. I think that's the time we have. Really appreciate you coming and being